The Battle for Liberty, Episode 13.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Battle for Liberty. Thanks for joining me once again. I'm your host, Mike Tilden. Welcome back to the podcast that's dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. For any of you new listeners, that's what this show is all about. We take you from full-on statist through your journey to libertarian. So subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. That really helps me out. And if you could do me one better, I'd really appreciate it if you could tell a friend about this show. Take a listen, see what you think, and then think of that one or maybe even two friends who you think is ready to hear something different than the liberal Democrat versus conservative Republican theme nowadays. As always, you should check out the site at battleforliberty.com. That's got all of the podcast episodes as well as all of our blog posts. You should follow us on Twitter at MyBattleLiberty. And if you want to email me, that's very easy. It's mike@battleforliberty.com. We'll have a show notes page for this show, as always, and that's going to be battleforliberty.com/13, being that this is the 13th episode. And that's that one convenient location for all of the content that we're going to talk about for this particular episode. So there's no need to go looking for content. You don't need to look for long URLs or do Google searches or anything like that. Simply head over to battleforliberty.com/13, and if we've talked about it on this episode, you're going to find a link there. All right. Well, welcome back. It's been a little while since I've had an episode come out. And again, as this is becoming the theme of the show, it's just my unpredictable travel schedule makes it very difficult. I had a Homer Simpson moment last weekend. I was traveling for work and I got into my destination city, which this time was Kansas City. And I got there around, I want to say, 1 or 2 in the afternoon, and I didn't have anything to do for work the rest of the day. It just so happened with the flight schedule that, you know, I just got into town a little earlier than I would have liked to, but that gave me a lot of time. And so aside from eating some great barbecue, I decided I was going to sit down and hash out a podcast episode, or maybe even two. And I opened my bag and realized I had left my microphone at home. And I couldn't believe it because I had time that was quiet. It was dedicated specifically for this purpose, and I couldn't do anything about it. I actually looked for 2 or 3 different music stores to see if I could find a USB microphone that I could purchase, and there was nothing within close driving distance. So I didn't get to record an episode on my last business trip, and that's why this one is coming out a little late. So anyways, I'm back in the seat. I'm back in my makeshift studio, we'll call it. And I am ready to talk about something that's on everybody's mind right now. And that topic, of course, is voting. So today we're going to cover a lot of aspects about voting. And I hope it answers some questions for you. Before I get into my actual voting for this is 2016, so for this 2016 general election, hang tight. Towards the end of the episode, you will hear specifically how I'm voting for all of the people on the ballot as well as all of the ballot measures for the state of Colorado. So if you're interested in that, hang on. It's coming. But before that, I think it's really important that we cover what my political philosophy is on voting in general. How does a libertarian approach the topic of voting? Okay, in previous episodes, numbers 9 and 10, we talked about what some people call anarchy, some people call anarcho-capitalism, what I prefer to call voluntarism. If you've listened to those episodes, great, then you understand what my beliefs are when it comes to forcing other people to do something for you, or using violence, or aggressing against people. If you haven't listened to those episodes, I would highly recommend you go on back and you listen to them. That's battleforliberty.com/9 and battleforliberty.com/10. And of course, if you're subscribed, which you should be subscribed on iTunes or Stitcher, if you're subscribed, all you got to do is open up your app and you can easily find episodes 9 and 10. But you should go back and listen to them if you haven't already. But if you have, you understand that maybe, or maybe you've thought this through logically, that maybe voting is something that's a little bit more complicated than what our society, or what I often refer to as the civil religion in this country, which of course is government, you may understand that from a voluntarist perspective, voting isn't the sacrament that the civil religion would have you believe that it is. So we're going to start there first. We're going to talk about voting in general from the perspective of a voluntarist, okay? And after that, then I'll comment on my ballot choices for 2016. So let's jump right in. First, let me just give a little disclaimer. Please understand that when I talk about voting, the last thing I want anyone to think is that I'm trying to tell you who to vote for, who you should not vote for, what ballot measures you should support or not support, or whether you should vote at all, okay? I'm not trying to make a comment about what you should do. I'm simply going to relay for you my perspective as a voluntarist in a general election year. And this is fairly important for me in my evolution from statist to libertarian, because this is the first general election year where I do consider myself much, much closer to the anarchy side of the spectrum. And I know all of you anarchists out there who are listening, you're going, well, anarchy isn't on the spectrum. It's different than right, left. Yeah, no, I get it. I'm with you. But most people see things as a spectrum. So if I'm trying to reach a bigger audience, you're going to hear me refer to anarchy as being on the spectrum with the rest of the political, world, so to speak. So, purist libertarians, if you'll do me a favor and just untwist your underwear when you hear me say that libertarianism is on the spectrum with republicanism and Democrats and all the rest, I'd truly appreciate it. Okay, so back to the original point I was trying to make. It's important to remember that this is the first time that as a voluntarist, I've been able to vote in a general election year. And so I've been forced to ask myself, how should I address voting? And as I've thought about that question, I've been forced to go back and think about the last time I voted. So I try to keep in mind that the last time that there was a general election where I was able to participate, that would have been 2012, that I voted for Mitt Romney in the general. Now, in the primary that year, I voted for Ron Paul, and I can almost promise you that I would have voted for him again in the general election had he made it that far. But it didn't happen that way. And clearly, as I voted for Romney in the general, it's clear to me now, I should say, that I hadn't developed my philosophy about voluntarism, libertarianism, whatever, because at that time I thought the Republican Party represented the majority of my views, and so I had no problem voting for Romney. Now, he wasn't my perfect candidate. I do remember that. I wasn't thrilled with him, but I was still somewhat indoctrinated into the system and believed that he would have been vastly different than Barack Obama. And, go back and listen to episode number one, and you'll understand how I've come from that opinion to where I am today. But as I verbalize for you where my thoughts or how my thoughts have evolved over the past couple of years, I think it will become very clear to you that I wouldn't vote for Mitt Romney today. So it's this lens through which I'm going to analyze my process this year, being that this truly is the first general election during which I would argue that I've properly developed a philosophy about voting and representative government. So we're going to keep that in mind as we go through this. Okay, so now that we've gotten all of that out of the way, to get started on voting, I think the first thing that's useful to do is to fully understand what it is we do when we vote. And so in order to do that, I'm going to break down voting into two basic categories. The first is voting for people, and the second is voting for legislation. I personally separate voting into those two categories because it's useful for me when I carry out my analysis. So let's start with voting for people. So when we vote for people, what are we doing? Well, I've thought a lot about this and I've read a lot about this, and this is where I come down. I think that when we vote for people, essentially what we're doing is we're selecting someone who supposedly is going to act in accordance with our own wishes or my wishes. And at least this is what the system wants you to think. This is what our system is set up to make you believe, is that you're choosing someone and they will then act in your act with your best wishes in their mind. Well, if you're a voluntarist and you believe that all human interactions should be voluntary, then I think it's pointless to vote for a person. Now, why would I say that? Well, when you cast a vote for a person, you're supposedly transferring your power over yourself to someone else. But in a democratic society, you're actually doing a lot more than that. So you see, in a society that believes in majority rule, you're not just transferring the power you possess over yourself, you're legitimizing a system that claims to have the power over anyone who's found in the minority. See, that's how democracy works, right? It's that old saying that democracy is two wolves and a lamb deciding what's for dinner, right? Well, so when you vote for someone else to have sovereign power, you're actually giving something away that's not rightfully yours. In no sense of morality that I can think of, can I vote for a representative to give away not only my sovereignty, but my neighbors as well. So when you participate in a vote for a person, you're actually legitimizing their monopoly on the use of force over others. I also happen to think that voting for a person is quite cowardly. And some of you may rail against that when I say that, but go with me on this. Let's think carefully about this. I'm going to give you a quick scenario. If I were to walk over to my neighbor's house with a gun in my hand and I rob them at gunpoint, most people would quickly say that this is immoral, correct? I think so. Even if I tried to justify this robbery by assuring to my neighbor that I would spend their money on charities for the less fortunate, I still think most people would say, no. You have immorally and criminally robbed your neighbor. It doesn't matter what you're doing with it. You're taking something that doesn't belong to you by force. That's wrong. But if I and all of my neighbors get together and appoint a representative amongst us to do the exact same thing, but instead we call it taxation, well, then it magically becomes okay. So what have I described here? Well, I'm describing a scenario for you in which you yourself won't do something because it's morally wrong and probably quite frightening to confront someone in that way. You see, that's human nature. We don't like to confront people. But the very minute you become empowered by the convenience of a distant and indirect relationship with your victim, well, then you'll charge ahead with that idea and vote for things that remove someone else's property unjustly. So put another way, when you cast a vote for a person, you're essentially transferring your own greed and lust for someone else's property, someone else's labor, to your henchmen, to the people that you've chosen to do your dirty work, because you and I don't have the stomach or the courage to carry out the task ourselves. Now, if that's not a textbook definition of cowardice, I don't know what is. So I don't believe in voting for people. I think voting for people is wholly incompatible with the non-aggression principle, and I choose not to take part in that aspect of election seasons. I'd also really like to draw in something here at this point that came from a recent Tom Woods show episode. He recently pointed out I don't know which episode it is, but I'm going to look it up and I'll put it on the show notes page. It was the episode where Tom and Lou Rockwell analyzed the final presidential debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Now, if you haven't listened to any of those episodes, they're gold. They're awesome. Anytime Tom and Lou get together and analyze a debate, whether it was the GOP primary debates, they did it for all of those, as well as two out of the three Trump versus Hillary presidential debates, you need to go listen to them. They're quite entertaining and pretty funny. So don't fear. I'll have a link to that on my show notes page, which as a reminder is battleforliberty.com/13. Anyways, the point that I want to bring in that Tom was making had to do with the fact that during the debate, Trump refused to vow that he would accept the legitimacy of whatever the initial outcome of the election was. And Tom was understandably frustrated that there were certain libertarians on his Facebook feed who were decrying Trump for this. Tom's point was that whenever anyone for any reason questions the legitimacy of an election, that for libertarians, that's a good thing. It's always a good thing to question the legitimacy. For, as Tom noted, the statist system relies completely on the masses accepting its legitimacy through elections. So as long as the masses continue to believe that elections authorize and empower the state, then the state will continue to push for elections, even if they're rigged or bogus or a sham. It won't matter because the people who are being enslaved by these elections are the ones who believe that the elections give them the authority to enslave them. It's a ruthless system, and Tom points it out quite nicely. So let's take a listen to a quick clip from that episode.
What is the biggest weapon the state has against us? It's actually not its weaponry and its technology. It's legitimacy. It's the idea that people think it's okay for them to rip us off and blow up people in other countries and to do all these things because they're legitimate, that this is,
right.
You know, these people have been chosen by us and they have legitimacy. So it's great, even if Trump doesn't get Rothbardianism, if he's undermining the legitimacy of the regime by saying he's not so sure he'll accept the results, that is an absolutely unambiguously good thing from a libertarian point of view. So I was very disappointed to be flipping through my Twitter feed, I beg your pardon, my Facebook feed last night, and to see libertarians saying, oh, it's terrible that he won't accept that. What? This is exactly what we're calling for. We want people, we want everybody to not accept anybody. That's what, so we're halfway there. You know, if they're not accepting the rule by the Democrats, we're halfway there, as Ron Paul would say in another context. So that's not his problem. The problem is that too few people will take that view, that most people will just stand around and say, yeah, I guess we got to accept it. Why? What is – there's nothing legitimate about any of these people in any sense. So if he's willing to say maybe some portion of the regime is illegitimate, then that means he's at least part of the way there.
All right. Well, as you can hear, Tom says it much more eloquently than I can. But that wraps up, you know, how I feel about voting for people. So no, I will not be voting for president. I will not be voting for town council. I will not be voting for a local dog catcher. Now, I'm about to contradict myself, and I'm going to explain why, so you don't think I'm a complete and total hypocrite. In this particular election, there happen to be a few people running for office for whom I'm going to make a very limited exception, and I will vote for a few people. Now, here's why. You gotta listen to this so you understand. The state where I live, which is Colorado, we actually have a Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate, and a Libertarian candidate for Congress, and a Libertarian candidate for state representative. And the only reason I'm willing to make exceptions for these people is because, number one, I know they will not be elected. I know there is no chance of that happening. So I don't fear that my vote will wind up violating the non-aggression principle. I don't think these people will wind up having any opportunity to lord their decisions over other people. Regardless of whether or not they're libertarians, they are human beings, and the trend for human beings is to try to control other people. So that's reason number one. I know there's no chance, there's no danger of that happening. But number two, I want to see the numbers for these libertarians get high enough that maybe more people start talking about libertarianism. Not necessarily the National Libertarian Party, but just enough people start seeing, hey, there's some other opinions out there. Now, you should notice that I am specifically not making an exception to my rule against voting for people. I'm not making an exception to that rule for Gary Johnson. I've already dealt with why Gary Johnson isn't a libertarian and how he doesn't hold non-aggression and property rights as his main values. And as you should know from listening to this show, those are the things that that libertarians at least in my opinion, should hold most dear. Our strict adherence to property rights and non-aggression. And Gary Johnson doesn't hold either of those values as his primary values. So if you want to know more about what I think about Gary Johnson, I would encourage you to go back and listen to episode 12, which is battleforliberty.com/12. All right, so that wraps up voting for people. Now let's talk about voting for legislation or ballot initiatives or specific laws. In my mind, this is a different type of voting, one with which I actually have no problem taking part. I see a pretty big difference between voting for people and voting for legislation. You see, in my mind, when you vote for legislation, as long as you consistently vote to take power away from the state, or you vote against measures that would increase the state's power, then you're not attempting to take something that's not yours. You're not attempting to assign someone else's sovereignty or control over their own property to a third party. So as long as you remain consistent with the non-aggression principle and with sound property rights, I feel it's okay to vote for or against certain pieces of legislation. And again, I'm gonna throw it back to Tom Woods as he would explain it, as he did in one of his episodes. If you're a captive in a prison cell and you're trying to escape, wouldn't you use every means at your disposal in order to escape? So, for instance, if your captors decided they were going to hold elections every so often, and all the prisoners could get together and vote for whether or not they would be free, wouldn't you vote to free yourself? I mean, wouldn't you find it ridiculous to abstain from voting just because your vote would somehow legitimize your captivity when your referendum fails? I would tend to agree. I go with Tom Woods on this one when he says you use whatever means you have available to you in order to remove power from the people who are lording it over you. So when it comes to voting for legislation, that's essentially how I feel. As long as I continuously vote in accordance with non-aggression and sound property rights, as long as my votes constitute a consistent effort to simply remove power from our captors, then I believe voting for legislation has no conflict with libertarianism or even anarchy. So that's my philosophy on voting, and it's taken me many years to arrive at where I am today. And maybe that will change. I don't think it will change quite as much as it has from statism to libertarianism. I think as a libertarian, my philosophy on voting is pretty well cemented at this point, but that doesn't mean I have a closed mind. So if you disagree with me, if you think I've gone wrong, I'd sure love to hear from you. You've heard in previous episodes that if your email is cogent enough and gives an opportunity for us to assess it and study it, I'll respond to you, and then I'll put it on an episode, as long as you agree. I always check with the listeners first. Okay, so that's voting in general. And so we've covered those two basic categories, right? We've covered voting for people and voting for legislation. But there's one final aspect of voting that I'd like to discuss briefly, and that's the efficacy of voting in a supposed republic of over 300 million people. So let's harken back way back to episode number one, where I told you about a book that was one of my starting points on my journey from statist Republican down towards the path of voluntarism. And this book truly changed my outlook on our form of government here in the United States. And that book, if you don't remember, is called Rethinking the American Union for the 21st Century. It'll be back on the show notes page as well, so don't worry about looking it up. One of the themes of that book is that the United States, as far as republics go, is completely and totally out of scale. You see, the founders, especially someone like Thomas Jefferson, they knew very well that in order for a republic to be effective at representing the wishes and political opinions of their constituents, republics had to be very, very small. And this book goes through and does just a masterful job at showing you throughout history that the effective republics were tiny. And anytime they got big is when they started to infringe on individual rights. And the founders were well aware of that. Number one, we know from direct quotes that people like Jefferson said things like, as the republic grows, it may be necessary that it breaks up into smaller republics, right? We also know this from the fact, from the structure of the republic as it was created. And I keep calling it a republic, but the point here is that the United States actually isn't a republic. The United States is a union of republics, right? They did that on purpose. They wanted to maintain these smaller state units that would be responsible for the majority of the governing that would go on. And that, you know, for the purposes of commerce and defense, that we would have a union of sovereign republics. And finally, we know that the founders wanted to keep the republic small by the way they structured in the Constitution that representation was supposed to max out at one representative for every 30,000 people. Well, when you read this book, Rethinking the American Union for the 21st Century, you are, at least I was, shocked to learn that we've unconstitutionally just altered that limitation on one representative for every 30,000 people. So today, I often do this in a fun way when I'm arguing with someone about whether or not their vote matters, right? This whole talk, this last portion about voting is about efficacy, right? Does your vote count? Does it really mean anything at all? And to that, I would say, no, it doesn't, because you as a person share a representative with guess how many people? Is it 100,000, 200,000? No, it's actually closer to 750,000 people. Okay, I don't know what the number is now. It fluctuates every time the population is declared to be, you know, 330 million versus 300 million. But nevertheless, it's somewhere around 750,000 people who are being represented by each representative. That's unbelievable. Do you think there's any way that any representative is accountable to you, the voter? No, of course not. And as I question people who disagree with this, one of the questions I ask is, have you ever contacted any of your representatives, any of your congressmen, any of your senators? And some of them say yes. And when they say yes, I say, okay, did they call you back? And most people say no. And if a couple people do say, well, yeah, I got a call back, my next question is, okay, was it from your representative or was it from one of their staffers? And did their staffer have anything intelligent to say or was it a canned response? And the answer is always, I got a call back from a staffer and they didn't have anything intelligent to say. It was a canned response that they're just, you know, trying to make it look like they're beholden to me when in actuality they're beholden to someone else entirely. So, as it relates to efficacy, I think it's fairly clear because our country is so far out of scale with representation as a republic that your vote really does not matter in any way, shape, or form. And every time I say that, when I say one person's vote doesn't matter, I inevitably get the Rosa Parks objection. They say, well, Rosa Parks was one person and she made a difference. And that's true. Rosa Parks did make a difference. I think what she did was very important, but they're getting it exactly backwards because when they make this objection, they think they're proving to you that you should work within a system in order to make changes. But when you look at Rosa Parks, what did she do? She did two very specific things. Number one, she did something public that everyone would see and everyone would know about, right? She rode in a portion of the bus she wasn't supposed to ride in. And she didn't work within the system. She blatantly ignored it and defied it. Those are the two specific things, right? Now think about your vote. Is your vote working within the system or is it defying it? Well, it's working within the system, right? That's what they want. And is your vote visible to people? No, it's on a secret ballot that almost nobody knows about unless you tell them how you're voting. So what you're doing when you're voting is exactly opposite to what Rosa Parks did. Rosa Parks was visible and defiant. You are compliant and invisible when you vote. So when people give me the Rosa Parks objection to your vote doesn't matter, my response is, isn't it far more like Rosa Parks to be defiant and refuse to participate in the system that supposedly legitimizes all of these things that you dislike? That's my position on voting efficacy. So take that for what it's worth. I hope it provides some fuel for your brain. And again, if you disagree with me, give me an email, mike@battleforliberty.com, or hit me up on Twitter. That's mybattleliberty. That's my Twitter handle. All right. So, To round out voting, before I get into how I voted this year, I want to respond to one of my listeners. And this was a question I got some time ago and didn't really have a lot of opportunity to answer it, at least not very well. And I still don't think I'm going to answer it as well as my listener would like, but I'm going to go ahead and try anyways. So a while back in the show's infancy, a listener asked me how I felt about voting this presidential season because of the high stakes that are being placed on the appointment of at least one and possibly up to three U.S. Supreme Court justices. Now, I find this question to be a little tricky, not because the listener is trying to trick me up, but because I think it's a difficult question. I'm completely confident in my philosophy of not voting for a person, namely President or United States, namely President of the United States. But I find this listener's argument to be at the very least compelling and worthy of some careful thought. And the listener's thought goes like this. In an election year such as this year, when we know that numerous Supreme Court nominations are at stake, wouldn't we want to assure that someone like Hillary Clinton, who is far more of a statist than, say, Donald Trump, that we assure that Hillary Clinton is locked out of the ability to appoint justices who could make widespread and sweeping decisions about our lives for the next 20 or 30 years? I mean, you know, if Hillary gets into the office, she's going to appoint justices who are very young and who are very progressive. And I think that's a great point. It's certainly one that I can't find fault with anyone for bringing it up or even for voting that specific way. So I have to say, you know, I have no pipe dreams that if Donald Trump is elected, that he'll have really any better track record than any of the previous Republicans who have appointed Supreme Court justices. But I understand if that's the way that you're going. It does make sense to me. But let me see if I can justify that statement I just made, because a lot of people probably heard that and said, what do you mean he won't have a better track record than other Republicans? Don't Republicans always nominate good Supreme Court justices? Well, unfortunately, it turns out they don't. So I want to take just a very quick look at Republican Supreme Court appointees who gave us some of the worst statism we can remember. So I'll start it off with Justice Anthony Kennedy, still sitting on the bench. And he frequently votes in favor of more and more state control, especially at the federal level. He was a Reagan appointee, right? A conservative president gave us Anthony Kennedy. He's certainly no friend to anyone who's a libertarian. Then we have Chief Justice John Roberts. I mean, he gave us the nail in the coffin on Obamacare. He was a George W. Bush appointee. Then you go back a little further and you find Justice Harry Blackmun. He supported Roe v. Wade. Okay, a lot of conservatives I know are very much against Roe v. Wade, and I've talked about abortion on this podcast before. We're not going to cover it right now, but supporting something like Roe v. Wade tends to fly in the face of Republican conservative nominees. Well, he was put on the bench by Richard Nixon. Sandra Day O'Connor, who a lot of people do like, she was frequently a swing voter, and she was a Reagan appointment. And then there's David Souter, nominated by George H.W. Bush, and he turned out to be a consistent liberal vote on the court. So what's my point here? I mean, I've only gone back, 20, 30, 40 years, and you can keep going back in history. What you'll find is the theme that people will fail you. Voting for a flawed person to become president in the hopes that he or she will pick another flawed person who will then make broad decisions about your life that you don't like, that's not a logical line of reasoning. You got to remember, people are going to fail you. It's why I've become a voluntarist. I don't trust anyone else to make decisions about my life. All I want to do is be left alone. Okay? All I want is voluntary interactions between me and the people that I choose to associate with. So no, it doesn't make a difference for me personally, voting specifically because of the Supreme Court. But like I said at the beginning, I understand if it's a big issue for you. I can understand that. I've been there before, and I know a lot of people are agonizing over this. So as I said in the beginning of the episode, vote for who you think you should vote for, or don't vote, or don't tell anyone how you voted. It's none of my business, and I'm certainly not going to attack you for it. I know there are some people who profess to be, peaceful libertarians who will then heckle you nonstop just for voting. I'm not in that camp. I have my beliefs, and I know you have yours. And I think a lot of people are just trying to do their best with a pretty crappy situation we have this year. So, speaking of crappy situations, I have my 2016 general election ballot in front of me. So here it is. We're going to go through it. I am going to go through this ballot step by step, and I'm going to tell you exactly how I voted, because I think it's interesting, and I think there are many things on this ballot that we can talk about. So let's get started. The very first one, of course, they always put, which I find to be right off the bat, flies in the face of how our system is supposed to work. They put federal offices first, as if the federal offices are the most important. When I think anyone with a brain between their shoulders would understand that the most important representatives for you in our system are your local representatives. So they really should be the focus, but of course they're not. We put the federal government first for everything. That's just the way it is. So in front of me, I have a ballot for President of the United States. And I'm looking at this and I'm kind of laughing at how people say we have a two-party system. Now I understand that, what they're saying is we have two primary parties, right? But I count 22 different tickets for President of the United States on my ballot. Absolutely hilarious to me. Now, the usuals are there, of course, Democrat, Republican, Green, Libertarian, they're all there. But I kind of wanted to read a couple of these for you. We have the Approval Voting Party. I have no idea who that is. The American Delta Party, the Prohibition Party, America's Party, the Veterans for America Party, the Socialist Workers Party, the Socialism and Liberation Party, the American Solidarity Party, and Socialist USA Party. And that's only some of them. All 22 parties, though, no matter who they are, I can promise you something. All 22 of these parties will advocate for statist control of your life. In some form or fashion, they want to control you. Now, arguably, I've heard some people argue that of all of the parties, the American Constitution Party, with their nominees Daryl Castle and Scott Bradley, they may represent the party that wishes to interfere in your life in the least when you compare them to others. But as far as I'm concerned, the American Constitution Party still believes in all aspects of taxation, including the income tax, as it's spelled out in the Constitution. So, based on that alone, no, I will not be voting for Daryl Castle and Scott Bradley. And they may not be on your ballot. They're not on the ballot in all 50 states. So just keep that in mind. Okay, so we're going to move on. There's my answer. I'm not voting for president. It's not happening. I thought about writing in myself. I thought about writing in a note that said, I will govern myself. But it's funny to me, but no one will read it. So who cares? It's more effort than it's worth. Okay, so next, United States Senator. This is one of those exceptions that I'm making. I am going to vote for a person. I'm going to vote for the Libertarian candidate, Lily Tang Williams. And I think it's really interesting that she is the only person on this ballot who actually has a parenthesis under her name that says she has signed a declaration to limit her service to no more than two terms. Well, that's interesting. That may get, 100 more people to vote for her. I think that's a decent move on her part. But again, there's no chance she's not going to be our senator. It's not going to happen. So I decided, why not vote for her and see if we can get the Libertarian numbers up just a little bit. All right, next is my congressman. Again, I'm making an exception. Bruce Griffith, the Libertarian, is running against a Democrat and a Republican for the same reasons as Lily Tang Williams. I'm going to go ahead and vote for him. Moving on to state offices, I have two regents of the University of Colorado that I can vote for. No, thank you. I will not be voting for any of them, because if they're running for regent of a state university, what does that tell you? Well, that tells you that they believe in stealing my money to pay for someone else's education. No, no thanks. I will not be voting. And then Let's see. District attorney. No. I mean, he's running unopposed. Who cares? So yeah, that guy's going to win. Then county commissioners, it doesn't matter whether it's Democrat or Republican, the county commissioners are always going to put stuff on future ballots to raise taxes. And just wait, we're going to turn this ballot over and we're going to read some of these ballot initiatives and you're going to see what I'm talking about. More county council. Ah, now we get to the judges. This is the one that I didn't count ahead of time, so I apologize. I'm going to count on the air. 15. 15 judges are on the ballot. And what's interesting in Colorado is they don't seem to be running against anybody. It simply says, shall Justice Daffy Duck in the Colorado Supreme Court be retained in office? Yes or no? It's not like Daffy Duck is running against Mickey Mouse, right? It's not this person versus that person. It's shall we retain them, yes or no? And so I did some digging, and it turns out, I guess, every couple of years, it's mandatory that they be on the ballot in so that we can recall them if we want to. So I think, actually, I haven't voted for any of these people, but this is breaking news. I think I'm going to change my mind. I think I'm going to vote for no for every single one of these people. Just remove them all. Take them all away. I think that's what I'm going to do. All right. That takes care of the judges. Now on to the ballot initiatives. This is where we start to have some fun. Remember earlier, about 30 seconds ago, I told you that all of these people would be advocating for things on future ballots that raise taxes. Well, wait till we get into some of these. All right, so Amendment T. In Colorado, we have a proposed amendment to the Colorado Constitution that concerns the removal of the exception to the prohibition of slavery and involuntary servitude when used as a punishment for persons duly convicted of a crime. That's a mouthful, and I'm going to be honest, I had to look it up to really wrap my brain around it. Here's what it comes down to. Currently, in the Colorado Constitution, slavery is prohibited, as it is in every state. But if you are convicted of a crime, that prohibition goes away. So if you're a criminal and you're in prison, the state can enslave you. It's in our Constitution that they can enslave you. If you refuse to work for them, they can punish you with violence. And so this ballot initiative basically says, can we take that exception away? Can we just have it say slavery and involuntary servitude are banned? Like, no slavery whatsoever for any reason, even if you're a criminal. So this is one of those opportunities that I spoke about earlier, where my belief is that this is something I should vote for. Because if I vote yes for this, that removes the ability for the state to enslave people. Well, that's compatible with the non-aggression principle and with property rights. You know, these people own themselves. If they don't wish to do hard labor, well, fine, lock them up in a prison. You could still lock them up. I mean, that's what our system does. But if they say, no, I refuse, what, are you going to beat them to death? So I'm going to go ahead and vote for that. Then there's Amendment U, which is exempts property tax. I don't even have to read it any more than that. Yes, exempt property tax. I don't care what it is. If you're stopping the robbery of people's money, yes, vote for that. Then we get into Amendment 69, which is Colorado Care. A lot of you outside of the state of Colorado don't know, but Colorado is trying to impose single-payer health care in the state. And so it's Amendment number 69, and here's how it reads. I'm not going to read you the whole thing because it's huge, but it says, shall state taxes be increased $25 billion annually? No. I don't have to read any farther than that. Shall we increase taxes? No. Okay, I'm voting against it. Amendment 70, shall there be an amendment to the Colorado Constitution increasing the minimum wage? No, I don't have to read it any more than that. No, I'm not for increasing the minimum wage. It's nothing but a market distortion that has the exact opposite effects on people than they would have you believe. Proponents of a minimum wage have you believe that it helps people, it gets them more money, blah, blah, blah. We all know that's false. All the minimum wage does is it prices out of the market low-skilled labor. So the very least skilled people among us have absolutely no chance to work and better themselves and move up the ladder because we've priced them out of the market. Makes absolutely no sense. All right, Amendment 71. Shall there be an amendment to the Colorado Constitution making it more difficult to amend the Colorado Constitution? No, I voted against that. There's actually, I had to do research on that one as well because I didn't quite understand it. But basically, as it currently stands, in order to amend the Colorado Constitution, all you have to do is get a certain percentage of signatures from the entire state. And it can come from anywhere in the state. So what people do is they go to Boulder and they go to Denver and they get signatures from those two cities and they get plenty and that's fine. Opponents of the current system, what they say is, well, I live out in the boonies, I live in farm area, and I'm not represented by this. So what they want to do, what this amendment is trying to do, is make it so that you have to get 2% of all of the registered voters in every senatorial district so that before something can change in the Constitution, you have to get 2% from every district so that at least every district has 2% of the people saying, yes, let's put this on the ballot. And so proponents say this would make it more representative of everyone in the state. Now, as Bastiat and Henry Hazlitt have taught me, though, you can't just look at it from one perspective. And the unintended consequence here is that what this would do is it would mean only the most well-connected and well-funded organizations, which, by the way, are typically organizations outside of the state who come into the state in order to do their social experiments, only the very well-funded, very well-organized would be able to achieve that 2% in every Senate district. And so effectively, it means that regular Joe Schmo can't get anything on the ballot. It doesn't change anything about whether or not you still have to get more than 51% of the vote in order for it to pass. So I voted against this. I think what this effectively would do is make it almost impossible for someone like me to try to get something on the next ballot to, say, remove state power, right? Okay, so that was a longer one. I apologize for that. The next one's really, really fast, okay? Shall state taxes be increased $315 million annually? No. Nope. I don't care what it's for. It's for tobacco taxes. They want to do more tobacco prevention. No. You know what? No. You're not raising my taxes for that. Stupid. All right, next, Proposition 106. This is one that's making a lot of waves because this is Colorado's attempt to legalize physician-assisted suicide. And I'm going to take a couple minutes to explain my vote on this one because I think a lot of people would think that this is not in line with libertarianism. But here we go. I'm voting no on Prop 106, and I want to tell you why. I'm going to start with a moral and religious level, and I know a lot of you don't like that I bring religion into this, and you know what? I'm sorry. I don't care. And then I'll go to a libertarian level, and I think the two are in line, so bear with me. On the moral and religious level, I can't ever vote for a law that makes it legal to kill someone, and it's that simple. This law makes it legal for doctors to actively kill someone. We're not talking about allowing a natural death. We're talking about actively accelerating someone's death by administering drugs that are designed to end their life. And I find this incompatible with the non-aggression principle. So that's the first level that I can't support it. But from a libertarian level, I wanted to bring that back into it because I know a lot of you are very interested in how libertarian politics come into this. I saw an awesome article by a guy named Ari Armstrong. He recently wrote an article on why we should oppose Prop 106 based purely on libertarian grounds. He brings up a number of really good points, and I want to read them for you now. His main point is that this law unjustly violates your right of association. You know from this podcast that I believe in voluntary association. Even when that voluntary association is distasteful to you, people in a free society should nonetheless be able to associate with who they want and to not associate with people that they don't want. And one of the sections of the law specifically dictates to private organizations what they may and may not do with respect to end-of-life practices. So the section actually says, quote, professional organization or association shall not subject an individual to censure, discipline, suspension, loss of membership, etc., for practicing or refusing to participate in good faith compliance under this article. Well, what does that mean? Well, he gives you a couple of examples, and they're great. He says, say a group forms, and they call themselves the Catholic Doctors Association, and that this organization explicitly condemns the prescription of end-of-life drugs. Under the new law, this organization would not be able to revoke membership of anyone who actually practices the prescription of end-of-life drugs. So a Catholic organization would have to continue to employ someone, even though they fly in the face of Catholic doctrine. This is a violation of voluntary association, and it should not be applauded by libertarians. Now, it goes the other way too, though. He gives a great example of the other way, lest you think I'm only thinking about the religious folks. Let's say there's a group called Doctors for End-of-Life Options, and it's explicitly in that group's charter that they endorse the prescription of end-of-life drugs. But under the new law, the organization would not be able to revoke membership of a member who refuses to take part in it. So if you have an organization that is specifically formed for one specific reason, and one of the members says, you know what, I'm opposed to that, they can't kick him out. So in both cases, you have a violation of voluntary association, which as a libertarian, I can't support. So for me, it's good for me because I can oppose it both on a libertarian level and on a moral level. I know some of you won't bring religion into it, and that's okay. But I think as a libertarian, you can also rest easily by not supporting it. That's if you want to. You vote how you think you're supposed to vote. That's not for me to say. All right. The next ones should be a little bit quicker. Next one, Prop 107. Shall there be a change to Colorado law? Prop 107 and 108 together want to allow, they want to force political parties to allow unaffiliated voters to vote in primary elections. And I vote no to both of these because I don't believe it's for the state to say in a political party, which is a private organization, by the way, I don't think the state can make rules for private organizations. I just don't. You may not agree with me, and that's fine. But the fact of the matter is the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, they are private organizations. And as they elect, as they nominate people to run for president in their private institution, they can choose who gets to have a say in that and who doesn't. And I don't mind states that say, you know what, you're not a Republican. No, you don't get a say in our primary. You're not a libertarian. No, you can't vote in our primary. That's fine. Again, this is all voluntary association, so I'm voting no to both of those. Okay, the next one. It's the longest thing on this ballot. And of course, what that means is it's a local ballot initiative for my local town to increase taxes by $1.9 million. And by the way, I live in a very small town. $1.9 million. And they want to keep increasing taxes for a number of years in order to pay for, drumroll please, the police. That's right. They want lots more money to be collected through new sales taxes, through use taxes. Basically, they want to increase all of these taxes in order to give the police more money. Well, no, sorry. They have plenty of money. They're wasting it. Figure out how to use it better. Or you know what? Maybe just abolish the police. But I know that's not going to happen. All right, last thing on the list, I promise. The local school district, what do you know? They want to raise taxes. What a shocker. The local school district wants to increase their allowable debt by $260 million, with repayment of that debt not to exceed $413 million. Okay, so there's the rub. People need to read this as, we're going to increase your taxes by $413 million over the next couple of years, but not more than $45 million annually. Yeah. They want to repair and renovate existing school buildings, put in additions, and equip new science, technology, engineering, and math programs. Blah, blah, blah. Public schools, something that my children will never take part of, and yet I will be robbed for the rest of my life to pay for. No, thank you. You may not rob me anymore. I will vote no. And that's it. That's my ballot. That was fun. I actually really enjoyed that. I hope you did too. Good luck this election season. I know it's difficult. We're all struggling with quite a lot of issues. I tried to cover as many of them here as I could. This was a little bit longer of an episode. It's actually the longest one I've done so far. So thanks for sticking with me. Thanks for listening. It's been a blast. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and please refer that friend. If you're not following me on Twitter, that's My Battle Liberty. Just do it. Just do it right now. Go to Twitter, look up at My Battle Liberty, and hit follow. Just do it right now. I'll even give you a couple seconds. Okay, if you haven't started doing it by now, you're probably not going to do it. That's okay. I'll get you. I will get you. You will follow me on Twitter. It's going to happen. Again, thanks so much. Until next time, battle on.